ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
Welcome to Investing with IBD Podcast. It's Justin Nielsen here, and it is November 15th, 2023, and we've got quite a show for you today. Joining me, as always, is Arusha Pierce from O'Neill Global Advisors. He's a portfolio manager over there. How you doing, Arusha?
I'm doing well, Justin.
Okay, a little bit better of a market to talk about, so that's always exciting. And helping us with that is Charles Harris, who is also a portfolio manager over at O'Neill Global Advisors. So I feel a little outnumbered today, but Charles, so great to see you. Charles, of course, he and I sat next to each other back in, what was that, 2000? Yeah, way back when. Yeah. And I got to learn so much from him. I was just starting out and he was about to become a portfolio manager. And, you know, he was running his own money and showing me what he was doing on the old ILX machine. And every now and then I'd hear him on the phone and then I'd say, oh, look, there's Charles. I can see his volume spike right there. So, wow. That was fun stuff. So of course, Charles and I also worked on the Market School product together. Gosh, we did a lot of projects together, a lot of fun. Between,
yeah, yeah. We worked closely together for at least a decade.
Yeah, he was in Bill's office, Bill O'Neill's office, the founder of Investors Business Daily. I was right outside looking in sometimes saying, gosh, looks like you guys are having fun in there. But great to have you on the show, Charles. One of the things we're going to be talking about, I think one of the favorite topics when you were at the master's classes, you know, anytime you've talked, I feel like you really hit the psychology part of trading so well. And you come at it from such a place of humility of like, hey, this is something we're all figuring out kind of together. And if I'm not mistaken, were you a psych major?
Yeah, I was actually a double major in psych. I mean, I started out math, computer science for 2 years, then decided I don't really like this.
Yeah, yeah, that so, South Campus part of UCLA was not exactly. Not attractive for you. Yeah,
It was like a different world when I went from South Campus to North Campus.
Yeah, I hear you. I was also thinking of getting my Bachelor of Science for a little while and then said, Bachelor of Arts sounds good. So, so let's get right into it and start with the market here. I feel like the market, there were all of these things we were asking of it, saying, well, the market's got to do this, the market's got to do this, the market's got to do this. And it seems like it's just ticking those off one by one. It's gotten above the 50-day moving average line. It's crossed the downtrend. It had a three waves down. It's now back above 14,000. Is it too good to be true, Charles?
You know, I think that, you know, we're all waiting for a pullback. Right. And like I was maybe looking at the three waves down following the, you know, the internet bubble bursting in that bear market that followed. So, you know, we bottomed there in October of 2002. We rallied up to the 200 day and then had the three waves down. And we had a nice move. What's that?
Are you talking about the 2003 precedents?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, and then we had the three waves down in 2003, and then we broke out and had a really nice sustained move. So I think, right in there. So we had this nice little 2 week window of consolidation before we went on that big run. And now, you know, I think, and whenever I hear anyone on TV or even on IBD Live, it's like, oh, I'm going to wait for the pullback, you know, we're going to get the pullback. And we should get a pullback, but I think when everyone's looking for a pullback, that's usually when you don't get a pullback. So I think, you know, we are going to have a couple, I think a few bad days in here. And I have no idea what's going to happen, but what my feeling is that, yeah, we're going to get a little pullback, but I think it's going to be very short and sweet. And if you're not invested as yet, or if you're way underinvested, you're going to have to maybe take some action or at least that's how I would handle it. But anything can happen. I mean, this has been one of those, it's just been a year where it's just been a lot of false starts. But I feel now with the inflation data being much more benign, and I think we're we feel pretty secure that the rate hike cycle's finished. And, you know, and it's been a really bad, it's been a really tough 2 years. You know, if you pull up a weekly or monthly on NASDAQ, I mean, a 2 year period of not hitting new highs, you have to go all the way back to the financial collapse in 2008 to have another period of that length of time before you've hit a new high. So it's been, you know, it has really worn us out. It's really been a nice combination. It really hasn't been that nice, but it's been a combination of wearing us out just time-wise and scaring us out, because the growth sector, and particularly speculative growth, like represented by the ARK funds, you know, were devastated and decimated. So, you know, those peaked 2.5 years ago. And you still have names like Shopify still off, you know, over 70%. You know, there's still like a lot of great stocks that are still, or at least former winners. I should say the ARK funds are down 73%. I'm not sure what Shopify is, but it's probably in that range. So yeah, I think that the market's been, it's been surprisingly strong these last few weeks, you know, rallying up about 13% in, you know, 14 days, which is pretty strong without any pullback. I mean, it's been up almost every day. And, you know, I looked at for a number of precedents for that kind of action. And I had, you know, and these I remember as we traded them back October 1998, following that little long-term capital blow up. And, you know, that was incredibly strong, right? I mean, it took off and it did not give you any opportunity to get in on a pullback for about 4 months. So, you know, the market, and we've only gone up for 14 days. So you never know what the market can do. You know, wouldn't it be amazing if we were in this kind of period? And I had no clue what's going to happen, but, you know, we are entering, I think, a new innovation cycle, just like we had the internet back in this time frame. We have AI this time around, and it does seem like this is something that's going to be truly profound and touch everything. And great bull cycles usually ride a wave of new innovation and technology and something really exciting, whether it's you know, the internet, or you know, the advent of the PC, you know, these kinds of, you know, secular shifts in technology usually coincide with these great runs. So I think, you know, the market can be a lot stronger than people think. And another in that same time frame, a year later, in October 99, you know, the final thrust of the internet bubble also took off from that kind of that kind of tough market environment where you know, kind of like that doesn't look, it looks pretty benign on the chart, but those, you know, I don't know what it was, 4 months or so of
the summer of 99.
Yeah. Where you kept hitting a new high and then pulling back. I mean, it was pretty brutal. But then when you finally took off, just like the market was up almost every day, and it pretty much held the 10-day moving average. And if you were just waiting around for, I'll wait for a nice 2-week pullback, it just didn't happen for a few months. So, I don't know what I'm in, but I have these periods of time in my memory. And so I am afraid of, I'm not fully deployed.
Well, it's a little interesting that you're using 2003 as a precedent, which was the start of like a recovery out of the dot-com bubble.
Yeah.
And you're also using as a precedent kind of the 98, 99, which was the end of a big, big move that we had for most of the 90s that preceded the dot-com bubble.
Yeah. And what I'm looking at is basically just periods of time when the NASDAQ, I mean, we can find more, but this periods that I lived through that are still in my memories, like almost like my little like intuition is like, well, you know what, this can go a lot further than people think. Yeah. Because I'm always looking to buy on a pullback, right? That's my style. But I do remember these periods of time when the market just kept running. And if you didn't get involved, you were left behind. Yeah. So, and I hear a lot of people out there who are, you know, I think there's still a lot of wariness that this rally is for real. Mm-hmm. I don't think that sentiment is overly bullish, even though we've had such a huge move in such a short period of time. I just feel like there's still a lot of money on the sidelines and people like, I don't know if I still believe it yet. And, you know, I don't know that we're not going to have a recession and, you know, we don't know what Powell's going to say. You know, he could just say, you know, higher for longer and that might, you know, hit the market again. So I don't know. I'm feeling like there's a lot of people afraid to really get involved. And now that things are running away from us, that makes it even harder. And what usually happens in those cases, you know, just human nature being what it is the, the market will keep going up until you just can't take it anymore. And you say, I just need to get in, and you get in, and then you're going to get a nice little pullback. So that's just how the market operates. You know, it operates in a way to fool the highest number of people. That's what I'm looking at. Yeah.
So it, you know, I think this is a perfect time to maybe bring up the market school, right? And the power trend, because we've had a pretty strong move over the last few weeks after this fall through day. And market school was designed to help us recognize, hey, when are you in some kind of unusual type of environment? And you quantified, you know, you and Justin and Mike Webster quantified a number of rules to help you stay in and try to capture the most of a really powerful trend. So maybe, and Justin, I'll interview you and say, why don't you explain this? So maybe just go over the definition of a power trend, because we're starting to get a little close to it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say we should test Charles because it's been 10 years. But I, you know, in the pre-show, he was doing pretty good. I was impressed.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned, like, you know, we'll talk about market school, and I thought you were joking. but I will say, I'm going to have Justin go over the explanation because it's far too confusing and it's been far too many years for me to remember all the ins and outs. But the beauty of the market school approach was that it's takes all of these kind of feelings and moves them to the side and say, well, what's the market actually telling us? And again, this thrust off the 200 day has been really powerful. And the model is saying you should be fully involved. And it's been that way for at least a week, I think. Mm-hmm. So basically, market school said, okay, never mind what you think or what the headlines are, what the news items are. What is the market telling us? And the market's saying it's acting strong and you should get involved.
Yeah.
And that was the whole point of doing this approach, was to really listen to what the market is telling us and not what our kind of feelings and emotions are telling us. And so, it's worked. And again, it's been telling us to get fully invested. And yet I think many investors are not fully invested. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
Well, I will say that one of the difficulties this time around has been this whole question of, you know, the market school rules really just look at the market index itself, specifically the NASDAQ composite. And with so many people talking about the breadth issue, it's like, does that translate to what you should be doing with stocks? Because, you know, the NASDAQ has been acting very differently from most of the stocks out there. And I mean, if you look at RSP, we were talking about how the equal weighted S&P 500 ETF, I mean, that looked so different. At least now it's back above its 50-day moving average line and, you know, right there at its 200-day line. But that was a big question mark. You know, we don't look at breadth. We don't look at, you know, individual stocks and leaders and everything like that for the market school rules. We're just looking at the index itself. But to get to the question, you know, on in terms of power trend, we do have a number of the factors in place now, and we're just waiting for the final piece of the puzzle. So we have the 21 above the 50-day moving average line. We just need that to be 5 days now. Tuesday was the first day where it was above that. We have the 50-day moving average line in an uptrend. This was actually one of the things that Charles came up with. He was, you know, really interested in kind of seeing that as a proof point that we were truly that strong. Although I will say Mike Webster was bringing up the question of whether or not maybe an EMA, an exponential moving average, would be a little bit quicker in getting that. So if you want to get the band back together, Charles, maybe we test that out. We also got one of the other elements today. We have 10 days where the low of the index has been above the 21-day moving average line. That's the green line on Arusha's chart here. So we've got that in play. So really, the final element here is the 5 days of the 21 above the 50-day, and this is day two. So we could see that as early as Monday for the power trend to be back on.
And then,
pivot on what you said, Justin, with regard to it has been tricky because not only has the breadth only really started to improve, and you know, I think in the last few days, I mean, I think there are a lot of stocks now to pick from,
right?
But yeah, breadth has been terrible up until very recently, and also it's been kind of strange because volume hasn't been that huge on many of the individual stocks that you think would have really nice volume. So like, you know, we always talk about Nvidia, but Nvidia, I think that has an AD rating of an E.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, that's not normal. That's not what you would expect, you know? So we've had this really light volume kind of rebound off the lows. And that's kind of also made me a bit skeptical or a little bit scared because, you know, normally, you know, you want to see some volume on the right side. And, you know, as you're approaching the high, you know, before maybe you get a nice little handle, and there just haven't been many elements of strength in terms of volume.
Yeah. So, you would expect that over the summer, but once we got past Labor Day, it's like, hey, where is it?
Yeah.
Where'd it go?
Really odd. And so, you know, when we used to do the workshops, and it was I did the sell signals, and, you know, low volume rallies were an indication of maybe, you know, institutions aren't involved. And even though we know that institutions are involved, but it's not showing up in the volume. So it's been a strange market. It has been. It hasn't been easy.
Getting back to the power trend. When you get into power trend, what is the significance of that, and what are you supposed to do? Right. Just maybe explain that process.
Are you talking to me?
That was for you, Charles. Okay. I'll remind Charles of what we talked about 10, 12, 13 years ago, whatever it was now. I mean, certainly one of the things was there were those times where you wanted to kind of slow down your selling. And so we implemented a few things, and it's funny because there were these time periods that we'd look at, and you know, you could have these moments where you were getting sell signals, but you know, you would come up so much. And so it's like, well, you were still kind of holding a lot of the gains you had. And, you know, maybe you were getting distribution, maybe you're getting these things, but you know, the idea was that if you had these massive gains on your stocks and you'd made all this progress, you probably didn't want to completely get out. So we implemented things like having a floor. We implemented things like having a little bit of a cushion to slow down your selling before you really, started, you know, having those sell signals be acted upon. But at the end of the day, we also had in there kind of, look, if you've got a distribution cluster, you've got to do some, you know, take some action because of distribution piling up. Or if you're below the 50-day moving average line, well, that's, you know, these are two things that would put that power trend under pressure. And then of course the final signal, which was usually very, very late, was that the 21 day would get back below the 50 day moving average line. That was usually, you know, we were usually long gone by that time in terms of our exposure. But any final thoughts on that, Charles?
No, you know, one thing that we never got around to implementing that if we kept doing it, we would have certainly is using margin in our model. And I think,
or shorting.
Right. Yeah. But in terms of the power trend, you know, when things are that favorable, technically, that would typically be a time when you could implement margin and just be more aggressive, because it's really telling you that the market's, you know, technically acting, you know, in a very strong way. And if you have the breadth and lots of, you know, choices, you know, in terms of stocks, that's when you can kind of be comfortable to push it a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in some ways, we often use the analogy of when you're playing blackjack, and if you're counting cards and you've got a favorable deck, you know, with the count in your favor, where it's time to, you know, take advantage if you can. So let's go ahead and take a pause real quick. We'll take a break. And when we come back, we're going to have Charles talk a little bit more about the idea of psychology, one of the most popular topics that Charles talks about in his sessions. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high volume, high speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Welcome back to Investing with IBD podcast. It's Justin Nielsen here, along with Arusha Pieris and my good friend, Charles Harris. Both of those guys are portfolio managers over at O'Neill Global Advisors. So again, we've got two O'Neill portfolio managers in the house. Charles, of course, has been doing this a lot longer. 23 years now for you? A little bit over that, if I'm...
I started managing money in June of 2000, so
June of 2000, yeah. So you just had your 23rd year. And again, I got to watch you in action. After you were having some of the best years ever, you know, 1,000% year was that in 99? I mean, that's how you basically got Bill's attention to become a portfolio manager. Like, you know, he just said, I want a piece of this. And you've had some phenomenal years in which you've just had these mind-boggling, you know, triple-digit gains in a year, and you've gotten back-to-back where it's, you know, compounded out to just, again, astronomical things. But you've also had the tough years, the times where things haven't gone right for you. You get a string of losses, and that can be really tough on your psychology. So how have you handled it, and what have you learned from the process?
Thanks for reminding me, Justin. Now, it's tough. You know, my career has been very much a roller coaster. I've been pretty open about it. And particularly, really, I'm talking about my personal account, not the firm account, because we don't do that at O'Neill, the roller coaster. We have a much more upward trajectory. And, but with my personal account, you know, I think where I can say I have a weakness, it's in my risk control. I get, you know, I can go on these huge runs, and I'm very slow to come to terms when I'm no longer hot. And, I do have a tendency to trade very aggressively. So, you know, I talk about in the workshops and, you know, when I do the trading psychology section, that over concentration and over leverage are the two elements of blow-ups. Like, you need both of them. And I do both of them. And so I've had quite a few blow-ups in my career. And excuse me. And And I actually, you know, I've given a couple of talks about this that are on YouTube. The first one was back in 2019 at the master's course, where I talk about really about a 3.5-4 year tailspin, where I blew up, you know, my personal accounts pretty much, you know, down like 85%. And that really took its toll in many ways, including, you know, it wasn't the reason, but it was definitely a participating factor in the fact that I'm divorced. Mm-hmm. So, I'm also best friends with my ex-wife, so, which is nice, but you know, it really, that financial stress and just the emotional toll it takes when you, when you're in a major losing streak and you just can't seem to get your, you can't seem to get out of it. You know, it just takes its toll on so many levels. So, so I gave
Charles,
that.
Charles, let me just interrupt that. And so, I mean, essentially that sounds like you're in the middle of a downward spiral right there. I mean, is there some kind of triggered to say that I'm back, I'm just in this downward spiral, nothing's going wrong, where you just have to walk away or anything like that?
Well, that's the problem. Walking away is what you should do, and basically stopping trading, coming to terms that you're just not on, and taking a break. But I never take a break. That's the problem. In fact, I don't think I've I mean, I've almost never taken a vacation. I mean, it's really, it's tiring after a while. But I am, you know, I do have this kind of bullish bent in me, and I have a lot of confidence. And when things are working, and, you know, I just think they're not going to stop. And I think, oh my God, I'm a genius. Well, I'm up 50-fold. Like, you know, I'm going to be up 100-fold, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, all the things I talk about in the trading psychology section of the master's workshop and all those rules and you know, the tendency for people to extrapolate short-term moves and to get overextended and not to set a line in the sand where you're going to begin to raise cash. All these things, you know, all these rules and ways of looking at things are so critical. But I mean, honestly, I violated every single one of them in these blow up periods. And so, you know, what I've talked about in these kind of personal journey presentations I've given, there's two of them. I just gave back at the first couple of days of September to a joint IBD meetup group up in San Francisco. And I talked about my latest blow up, and which was truly my most profound blow up in terms of money and in terms of percentage. I mean, like, I thought it couldn't be worse than 2014 through 17, but
you thought 87% was as bad as it would get.
Yeah,
huh?
Wow, that was pretty bad. But this is like literally, this was a true, really a blow up. And so in my margin account, thankfully, I'm not allowed to margin all my accounts, so I survived in some of my accounts, but this one was truly profound. And so what I've talked about is that it's not enough to know what rules you're breaking, because, you know, you can do a post analysis and discover where you're going wrong. And if you do a post analysis when you're in the midst of a losing streak, you'll realize that you're trading when the general market's not in your favor. You'll realize that you're not cutting losses. You'll realize that maybe you're buying extended. You'll see all the things that you're doing that are wrong. And it's, you go, okay, well, that's pretty simple. I know what I'm doing wrong. But it's not enough, because for me, I know that what I'm doing wrong, it's just I keep doing it. So yeah, you have to go a little deeper, or a lot deeper actually, and discover, well, why am I breaking these rules? And why do I keep repeating this cycle of, you know, making a great deal of money and then losing a great deal of money. Mm-hmm. And for me, and I've been in therapy now for a number of years, not just over this, but it's all related, whether you're talking about relationship or just your feeling of worthiness or the market, everything is kind of the same origin in a way. And for me, I mean, I can't go in great detail in this short segment here, but you know, I go into great detail in the presentations that are on YouTube if anyone wants to see. But really, what for me, what it's came down to is this feeling of kind of worthiness or a lack of worthiness, and this like a deficit there. And for me, more money meant more value, and so it was really get this insatiable appetite to feel good inside, and it couldn't be satisfied. So no matter how much money I made, I just kept putting the bar higher. Like, it was never enough. And in this last run that I had, people always ask, so what happened when you blew up your account, you know, and did that first presentation, like lost 87% of your money? Did you, were you able to come back? And I did. And I thought it might take 10 years to come back, or at least. But I came back. The COVID, you know, as bad as it was good for our, it was good for traders who knew
good for our style,
who knew for our style and where to deploy those funds. And of course I got on board on Tesla, and I made back all that money and then much, much, much more in a 2-year period. I was up almost 50-fold, which is, I've never had a run like that back to back, you know, that, that compounded to those types of gains. And then I managed to lose a great deal of it. And in my margin account, literally blow it up just because I was so concentrated and so, you know, playing with a lot of leverage. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, when I was making that money, it was just like an itch I couldn't scratch. It's just like, I just kept playing. Like, I couldn't take, I wasn't sober enough to take, to kind of look at my account and say, wow, I just made a lot of money. I don't have to work anymore. I'm going to take half of it out, put it in the bank, and play with the other half. Like, that, that would have been the sensible thing to do.
Well, and Charles, I know that's something that you were doing before, you know, with a number of the runs that you went on before. I know that was something that you typically did.
Yeah, well, I always am, right, selling into strength, right? But the thing is, I always redeploy on a pullback. And sometimes these pullbacks turn into major bear markets. And rather than saying, oh my God, this is no longer a pullback within an uptrend, this is now a broken stock or a broken market, I just keep thinking, yeah, but I know this stock. I know this. This is my long-term one. And I honestly, that's what I did with Tesla, was I said, you know, I'm holding this stock for 10 years. I don't care what happens. I'm holding it. That's how much I believe in it. And I still have that belief. But when you're concentrated and on margin and a stock falls 75%, it doesn't matter. You're going to go broke. That's just how the math works. So, you know, if had I not gotten margin calls, I surely would have been, I would have lost that entire account because, you know, I had to raise funds. I was forced to raise funds. I didn't want to, but I had to.
Charles, I mean, it almost seems like, you know, when things were going so well and you're talking about the not being worthy of it, that it's almost like a self-sabotage, right? Where
it's definitely an element of it, Arusha, that it is self-sabotage on many levels of feeling like, you know, there's two things you can do when you don't feel like you deserve your performance or your wealth. You either maybe get some therapy and change your mindset and say, you know what, I do deserve it. I work hard and I am a good person and I've, you know, talented in this one little way and I deserve it. And then there's the second way, is like not believing you deserve it and then sabotaging yourself and taking whatever actions you do, even if they're kind of unconscious, to basically put your external environment back in line with how you feel internally, which is what happened to me. Basically,
right.
I said, you know what, this, I don't deserve this money. And then I lost the money. So, you know, one thing that is interesting that we're doing this segment today is I had a I met with my therapist yesterday, and we were talking about the market the whole time. And I was telling her, like, so yesterday, right, was a big day in the market, right? Yep. And I had a big day in the market, you know, in my personal account, a big percentage day. And I was telling her how I'm just a little bummed because the amount of money I made off my new base was whatever it was. Let's just say I made 40 grand or something, which is like, that's a lot of money. Like most people would say, well, that's a lot of money. Good job.
For day's work. Yeah.
For day's work. It easily would have been seven figures 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I'm used to playing with bigger numbers. So it's kind of like, I was just bummed. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, wow, this is a bummer. And so one thing we talked about, which is really important, I think this is a message to the to the audience about how to protect yourself from blowing up and really messing up badly is really implementing some level of self-care where, like, for me, I'm most comfortable when I have a lot of money in the bank. That kind of allows me to take on the risk I take on in the market because I know, like, worst comes to worst, I'm going to be okay. I've got money. But over this last period, my cushion is much smaller, you know, in terms of savings. It's just, it isn't what it was because I kept taking money and putting it in the market. So I've implemented this approach of taking out 25% of my profits every time I reach a certain level. And what my therapist, you know, we were talking yesterday and I said, you know, it's going to take me a long time to get back to where I was. And she said, where you were in terms of money? And I said, yeah. And she said, yeah, but when you had all that money, you weren't happy. It wasn't enough. Well, you know, it's never been enough for you. Like, what do you think you can do different? And what will be different this time? And I said, well, I think what's going to be different this time is that I'm aware of the fact that I need to take care of myself and pull money out of the market and not put it all at risk because, you know, I now have this awareness of, you know, the tendencies that I have and the fact that I don't need to have, like, I do have this kind of new sense of worthiness that I don't need to prove it and I don't need to have an unlimited amount of money. And so anyway, what she kind of said, asked me to maybe try doing, which I just started today, by the way, is rather than wait till you hit a certain level to take money out of the market, every time I have an up day, I'm going to take 25% of those profits and just move it into savings. And she said, try it for 3 months and see how you feel. Like, do you feel safer? Do you feel like you're taking care of yourself? Is, you know, because one of the things I told her was, I feel uncomfortable not having enough money in the bank. So just today, you know, I sold a teeny bit of my stocks and I wired money out of the market into my savings, and that's where it's going to stay. And I'm still playing with 75% of, you know, I still have my base and 75% of the profits I'm making. So really, the realization is kind of like, how did she say it? She said, this is how you parent yourself. Like, it's uncomfortable for me not to be fully in, mm-hmm. leveraging everything I've got and going for it. Like, that's my default. My default is just putting everything I can in the market, especially when we're in this kind of market, and building my wealth as quickly as I can. And this is a different Charles now in a way, because by taking money out every time I'm making money, I'm on, you know, mathematically, it's going to take me longer to recover.
Right.
I'm going to make less money, assuming that I'm trading well, but I'm also taking care of myself and building up, you know, kind of replenishing my savings and just taking care of myself. So, you know, I'm in less of a rush than I was, and I'm dealing with that uncomfortable feeling of, I want it now. I want more. and saying, you know what, you can't have more now, but you're going to take care of yourself. You're going to move money into savings, and you're going to take care of yourself in that way. And you still have three quarters of your profits on top of your base to play with. So that's what I'm doing. I'm going to do it for 3 months and see if how it makes me feel. Like, so far, it actually feels good.
Yeah.
Only been a day, but and so that's it. But the presentation I give, you know, it's an hour presentation, the last one, which goes into quite a great deal of detail, just into my life a little bit, and maybe why I am the way I am. And but anyway, it's it's dealing with your demons, and it is really what it takes to keep it. You know, there's many people can make it in the market, but keeping it is a different story. And so, and for me, I've always been very black or white. Like, I'm all in, all out, you know, all good, all bad. And this is really a way of tempering that and saying, you know what, I'm going to take a little bit out and put it into savings and play with the rest and just keep doing that. And I think that is I think it's also going to be, in a way, self, kind of, this is what I'm looking for, Justin, where I'm, by doing this process, it's going to kind of build on itself.
Yeah.
And
self-fulfilling,
kind of be a virtuous cycle of feeling better and safer as I'm progressing. So,
and making better decisions.
That's well, yeah. And before Justin, before you ask your last question, I just want to say, so, cause Charles and I are on daily meetings every morning. We usually keep Charles to the end to make his comments about the market, because he's always the optimist. He's always the bull. And it's very helpful, especially the last few months when, you know, I get bearish really quickly. I'm like, okay, this is never going to go up, but we always have Charles there to remind us, and he's always looking at the positive side of, and it's very, very powerful, because in the end, you know, the markets do have that long bias. So it's always great to have Charles go at the end to just remind us, hey, we're close to a fall today, stocks are setting up, and it helps shift all of our mindsets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one other thing I wanted to ask you about, Charles, is how you've been handling these accounts differently. You talked about your margin account, and certainly over concentration plus margin can equal great success or great disaster, right? It's you have to be very careful with that. But you know, your firm account handled very differently. Certainly there's an accountability there. You know, other people are watching, and you can't just, you have to justify your actions to a certain degree. You know, with the Roth account, margin's just not available. You know, you can't do it. That's not something that you can do in a Roth account. So maybe talk about the difference. And you know, I also should mention that, I mean, I remember how your ex-wife at times would kind of be there to build you up after you had kind of a rough time, and hey, you can do it. You've done it before. You can come back from this. So there's all these different levels of the outside kind of influence too. Can you talk a little bit about how that plays into it?
Yeah, you know, when I first started trading and I first had my early success and I had my early kind of blow ups or pretty significant drawdowns, I wasn't sure whether I had just been lucky or, you know, if I actually can be good at this. And early on, I thought I was probably just lucky. I mean, it, you know, and a lot of it had to do with this, the general market was so favorable in the late 90s that we could just get away with a lot.
Yeah.
And everyone seemed to make a lot of money in that time frame. I mean, you didn't have to be a trader. You can just, you know, open up the newspaper, throw a dart, buy a stock, and you made money. But over the years, you build a certain confidence up that, wow, yeah, I've blown up or I've had some pretty significant drawdowns. I need to fix this, but I always come back. So deep down, I have this kind of like inner confidence now that has happened so many times that I know I can make money in a good market, and I'll make way more than my share when conditions are right. I just need to fix the drawdowns. But yeah, I mean, with regard to how I trade the accounts differently, I would never trade someone else's account, you know, that I have a fiduciary duty to, the way I trade my account. I take on a lot more risk in a way that my own account is really almost more a personal reflection of me. And because I have had to deal with, you know, I've dealt with these issues of value and worthiness, that's kind of how I prove myself. You know, more money means more value, means more worthiness. And I don't treat the other accounts that, certainly any accounts that I trade for other people, don't, you know, that doesn't represent me. That's my job. And I'm trying to protect them and to make them as much money as I can and be responsible about it. So somehow it is just a different way of looking at things. And of course, you are assessed and you know, there are people looking over your shoulder. So you can't just go in and violate your rules. So that's a big difference there between trading for other people and trading for yourself. Mm-hmm. But that's not an excuse though. I mean, you know, that's just what can happen though, is, you know, when there's no one looking over your shoulder, you know, it's possible if you're not aware, to really mess up. So there's that. And then with regard to the Roth account, you know, just the fact that it's not a margin, you can only do so much damage. I don't really trade them that much differently, but the Roth account is a much slower way of trading for me. And I just, the margin account is almost like, I just go for it. You know, I'm just aggressive. I mean, I'm aggressive in all my accounts, but I'm ultra aggressive on the margin account because you can just make so much money trading on leverage. And so anyway,
it's fun when it works, right? But you know what, not to put on the therapist chair here, but I think it's interesting that you said for the accounts when you're trading for other people, how you feel like you have to protect them, you know? So maybe you have to do that for yourself too, you know?
Well, yeah, that's
learn to protect yourself.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's what I think I'm talking about now with regard to like self-care and pulling money out and putting into savings, is that is a way of protecting yourself.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
And so that is what I'm doing finally for myself after all of these years. Wow.
Right. The parenting yourself, delaying gratification a little bit, you know, for that extra protection and savings. But great stuff, Charles. Really appreciate you sharing your story. Hopefully it's something that a lot of our listeners can learn from. And, you know, it's a reminder that no matter how good you get, you always have to be aware of these pitfalls in the game of trading. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. And Charles is going to talk to us about some of the stocks on his radar. We'll be right back.
Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI.
Welcome back to Investing with IBD. It's Justin Nielsen here, along with Arusha Pieris and Charles Harris, both portfolio managers at O'Neill Global Advisors. So great to have their insights. I mean, we get Arusha all the time, but you know, it's always great to have Arusha, but it's even more special to have Charles here. So Charles covered a lot of great stuff, and he kept on mentioning the YouTube. You know, there's two actually, Trader's Journey, YouTube things to watch. So if you just go into YouTube and you know, put in Trader's Journey, Charles Harris, you're going to get both of those showing up. So definitely worth checking those out to kind of get the full story, all the emotional ups and downs of the whole journey. You're just getting a little taste of it here. But let's get into stocks, and we can also start with at Duolingo. The Duolingo here, it's had this massive move last week, and it's consolidated a little bit. But what is it that you like about this stock here, Charles?
So I do have a small position in it. I got in a bit late, but the way I'm kind of handling this, the current market and where I'm positioning is, I'm kind of bifurcating my approach between stocks that are breaking out to new highs, and particularly, you know, in a beginning of a new bull market, and hopefully this is the beginning of something that's sustainable. IPOs are really where there's a lot of potential for big moves. So this is a, you know, relatively new issue. It, you know, it was again brought down with the market, but the numbers are good. The they're expanding their offerings from just languages to, I think, to math now and just different areas, educational areas.
Yeah, they just added music as well.
Music. And I actually was using it in Spanish, but I know you said you had a 400 days straight on Duolingo.
398. A little bit. Yeah.
I think I lasted 3 or 4 weeks, and then I got tired, and then they started sending me these like really sad faces. Like, what happened?
Yeah.
So yeah, I ended with "Hola, ¿cómo estás?" and I didn't get much further. But
okay, well,
I'm gonna go back.
That'll get you pretty far. At least you're friendly.
I'm gonna go back, but the volume, huge volume gap up on earnings. And so, it, you know, it was extended immediately. And sometimes it's really hard to get into stocks that gap up like that. If you, you know, you kind of miss a pivot, and it's, you know, inherently more risky to buy a gap up, because how do you know when you're wrong? Mm-hmm. So the way I handle these and the way I handle this is I did get involved on the gap up, didn't get the greatest prices. But it was just a very small position. So it's kind of a pilot position. And I bought more today. So, and I plan, what really what I would like to do is try to buy on the 10-day moving average, mm-hmm. which is, you know, probably down another 5% or something. So, you know, we don't know where, what's going to happen to it, or if it's even going to work. But again, these are the types of stocks that have great potential at the beginning of a new bull market. You know, IPO stocks, there's no overhead, you know, this is a new high ground basically, and they can have tremendous runs. In fact, I have a whole notebook of stock, you know, gap up stocks and how they behave. And, you know, the first 7 to 10 weeks of a new run like this, if conditions are right, you know, stocks can easily run 30-40% from the close of the breakout, from the gap up. So, you know, no clue what's going to happen, but I'm, you know, this is one of the stocks I'm trading and looking to kind of fill out a position on a pullback. Because again, you don't want to just buy when the stocks are, you know, way, way extended. Now you are opening yourself up to a lot of risk.
So Charles, went on the, so right now you made a small position on the gap up day. Did you make another little small position today on the pullback or a little bit?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then you're going to wait for it to pull back to the 10 day.
Ideally, I would love to kind of buy a bigger chunk on the 10 day moving average
and look for maybe an upside reversal or something like that.
Yeah. And if I got an upside reversal, maybe a shakeout under the 10 day with an upside reversal, I would get pretty aggressive. Mm-hmm. And that's awesome. Just how I would handle it.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and shift gears a little bit to the housing sector. And we can take a look at Toll Brothers. A lot of the housing stocks look the same. And, you know, this was a move earlier in the year that had some people scratching their heads with interest rates getting so high, mortgage rates getting so high. Why were the home builders doing well? And you know, they corrected and, you know, got support at the 40-week moving average line, and here they are back. Toll Brothers at new highs, and this is actually, I know that you played the housing sector really well a little bit over a decade ago. You know, and you had some experience just with your job before trading, kind of understanding the real estate market. So what's your assessment of these right now?
Yeah, so I guess because I did have a big play in housing way back when, you always seem to come back to the things that you were able to do well in the past. So I'm always kind of looking at housing. You know, if you look at and normally I trade tech stocks. I mean, most of the stocks I trade are technology related or biotech or, you know, very growthy types of things. Some retail, maybe. Housing moves, you know, is much more cyclical, and they can go on large extended runs, but generally they don't move like growth stocks. But if you kind of get the timing right, you can do really well in them. There's been an undersupply of new homes for really since the last housing crisis, back in the mid 90s. Builders never really replenished in the way that they normally do. Usually housing is a very much a boom and bust sector, but ever since the financial crisis, actually before the is it the mid 90s? Now, maybe I'm talking about 2007, 2008. Yeah, ever since that time period, they weren't building the way they used to. They used to really become much more speculative, buy a bunch of land, build a bunch of houses on spec. And at the top of the cycle, they'd be left with a ton of homes they can't sell. And, you know, and the stocks would crash. So they kind of, you know, got religion back after the housing crisis and just never built the way they did. So there's really a supply demand imbalance for housing. And even with these elevated interest rates, there's just not enough homes for people to move into. And so we have, you know, strong supply demand, you know, factors involved here. And now we have rates that have probably peaked for good and maybe on the way down. So, you know, interest rates, you know, housing stocks are very, very sensitive to interest rates. And now if they're moving in the right direction, these can maybe go on another run. And you can see how powerful the advance has been just over the last 3 weeks. Like if you pulled the daily back up, just gap up after gap up off the 200 day. And that's a super strong looking chart. So
yeah, not even earnings, no earnings reactions here. It's just, that's pretty right. Remarkable.
And they all look like this. They all look like this. But there's a, you know, a lot of, you know, RS line at new highs, stocks been under accumulation, really solid volume coming off the bottom. So, you know, this is an area where I'm, you know, looking for a pullback because, you know, this is literally straight up off the bottom. But if we can get a pullback, and even if the market doesn't have an extended pullback, like I think we're all waiting for, it doesn't mean that stocks that are have had a move like this can't pull back for a week or two and give you a low risk entry point. So you remember back that in the day, Justin, when Netflix moved right up off the bottom, mm-hmm. rested for a week or two and then began a long sustained move. I know we used to show that one, preview that one in the workshops. So housing's another area that I think is, you know, there's a lot of potential, and not that we focus on PEs too often, but the PE ratios and all these housing stocks are between like 5 and 7. So I can't read. What's it say there?
6. It's at 6 right now.
Okay, there you go. So, you know, I almost feel like this is not a lot of risk. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they're making money. Their profit margins are strong, even though they've been compressed recently or coming down because, you know, they've got to incentivize people by buying down the interest rates and so forth. Mm-hmm. You know, that's going to probably end. And I think profit margins can maybe reaccelerate. So I like housing. And do you want to move on?
Well, did you want to just kind of finish that thought?
Yeah, no, that's it. I think the housing, I think this, again, the combination of the interest rate environment becoming more favorable, and the supply-demand characteristics of the sector both bode well for housing. So I think that's a could be a really good area. And then one thing, the way I'm approaching this market is kind of bifurcating between these stocks that are breaking out to new highs. So we just showed the Toll Brothers, and DHI is another one. And then we showed the Duolingo. So again, those are traditional stocks at new highs that, you know, kind of an O'Neill type approach. And then the other place where I'm focusing on is in turnaround stocks that may have a lot of overhead supply, like a Shopify is a stock I'm involved in that is still well off its highs of a few years ago. But it's, you know, those highs are now long enough ago that I think the overhead supply is probably not going to be as, you know, as important and difficult to break through. And again, they reported a really nice earnings number. It's, you know, they make money, and they, if you pull up the daily chart, you know, that really huge gap up on earnings off the bottom, and it's just extending those gains with the market. So it's obviously extended on a short-term basis, but if you were to draw a line over the declining tops, you know, it's finally come, moved above those recently. And I think that was an ideal time to get in, even though it looked extended.
Yeah.
You know, this is, I think, a stock you can begin a position in and hope for a pullback.
Right.
And that's the way I'm treating these is I want to be careful not to just buy extended because I've been burned so many times, but this market does start, it is feeling like you can kind of get away with that a bit, and you might be forced to, because again, the market typically doesn't act the way everyone wants it to. And so again, I think there's a lot of money on the sidelines waiting for that nice, easy pullback. And it might be more of a news related thing, or just a really bad opening or something where you have to start to get involved. So normally I have a rule that the first day down, you never want to buy, because it's very rare for a stock to have a 1 day pullback.
Right.
But like today in Duolingo, it's the first day, but I bought small, mm-hmm. you know, and I put some limit orders in below the market, and you know, maybe I get hit, maybe I don't. So
that's how. Yeah, I just want to quickly point out here in the ownership block, you can see like Contrafund has really increased
from
0.8 to 2 million in the last quarter. JP Morgan's jumped from 10 to 14. So you are starting to get an increase in some of the institutional sponsorship from the IBD Mutual Fund Index.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you look at that weekly chart, and we have this, you know, kind of black line on the weekly chart that, you know, a lot of people don't know where that comes from. And it's really an 18-month line. And Bill, a lot of times, would say that, you know, once you get to 18 months, the overhead supply becomes less relevant. I wouldn't necessarily say it's irrelevant, but less relevant. And I remember him originally saying that with Yahoo.com. Back in 2003, it was coming out of a perfect cup with handle on the follow-through day on March 17th. And yes, it did have this overhead supply that it was looking at, but it was getting old. And, you know, to your point, Charles, I mean, this was down 87% off of its high. And it's still off 60% from its high. You know, so it's certainly, you know, not our typical, but I mean, it's almost up 200% from its bottom. So it's moved quite a bit already. So.
Yeah, and there are a lot of stocks like this because, you know, the growth stocks and the more speculative growth stocks, particularly the ones that were benefiting during COVID. So Shopify, you know, being an internet retail stock, you know, benefited during that time frame. They really got massacred. Mm-hmm. So again, down 80 to 90%, a lot of stocks. And, you know, they don't, you know, this is, you know, other than Amazon, you know, one of the really a true leader, you know, stock that's proven in the past that it can make a major run.
Yeah.
And this is, again, the other company in that space. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, you know, how high it can go at this point, but it's still a high PE stock, but it's, these are the areas I kind of want to be involved in, the traditional O'Neill growthier type sectors.
Yeah.
And so again, I'm looking at new merchandise and then kind of old merchandise. I would call this like a fallen angel.
Yeah.
That can restore itself.
But to be clear, this is very different from, you know, some of those COVID era. I mean, you look at Zoom, you know, ZM, that's still, yeah, you know, yeah, that hasn't made a 200% off its low. Yeah. DocuSign, Peloton, you know, right, some of these high flyers, you know, the fact that Arusha bought a Peloton, yeah, was not enough to save it. So
they're much cheaper now too.
Right. Well, hey Charles, it's always great having you on the show. We really appreciate you sharing your story and sharing your thoughts on a lot of these stocks. I think it gives our listeners a lot to think of. Again, for folks that want to catch his YouTube talk, The Trader's Journey, if you just go Trader's Journey, Charles Harris, or you can go to @CharlesHarris at YouTube. And are you active on Twitter? I know you sometimes dabble a little bit.
I dabble a bit. I mean, I should post more often, but yeah, I'm on there every so often.
Okay. So that's another place that people can, you know, check you out. What is that? That's Chaz. What is your Twitter
Chaz
handle?
Chaz Harris.
Hold on. Let me
Chaz Harris. Chaz.
Yeah.
Harris.
Is it 1025? Right.
Yeah. So okay. Wanted to make sure. So that's definitely another place that people can kind of follow along with some of your thoughts. Again, great having you, buddy.
Really appreciate it. Like to do it in the future. Always love to see you guys.
Well, definitely. That's not a problem. You're going to regret saying that. We'll have you on. You're going to be the new Arusha. So we'll have you on every week. Okay. That's going to wrap it up for this show. Thank you so much for watching. And please join us next week when we're going to have David Saito Chung, the Hat Man, back on the show, sharing some thoughts with us. And we're going to do it a little bit early next week because it is the Thanksgiving holiday. So you can expect that to drop on Wednesday instead of Thursday. We're going to tape it a little bit early for you. So thanks a lot for watching. We'll see you next time. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast if you haven't already. We'd really appreciate it. You can also send us your questions and comments to investingpodcast@investors.com. We would love to hear from you and may use your comments on an upcoming episode. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only, and nothing should be construed as a recommendation to buy, hold, or sell any securities. Make sure to consider consulting with your financial advisor before making any investment decisions.